Murray Taylor is a smoke jumper. He fights wildfires in remote regions by parachuting into the periphery of the fire. He's been at it since the mid-60s, and now at the age of 59, is the oldest practicing smoke jumper. He's jumped fires in 7 western states, Canada, and Alaska, where he's based during the fire season. He has a new memoir based on his experiences called Jumping Fire. This has been a bad fire season, but his season got off to a slow start. In late April, the Bureau of Land Management placed a moratorium on smoke jumping while it investigated the accidental death of a smoke jumper caused by a faulty parachute. The moratorium was lifted July 10th. I asked Murray Taylor to describe what he's looking for when he's looking down on a fire from the air.
A fire usually is headed in some direction. Due to the topography, it's burning uphill, or due to the wind, it's burning to the west or whatever. And we look at the fire in 4 different parts. There's the tail back at the back end of the fire, and then there's the head up in the end where the wind is blowing it. And then, so looking from the tail, there's the left flank and the right flank. And we always discuss fires in terms of what we see on the left flank, the right flank, what the head looked like it was doing, and how cool it was back at the tail. We typically begin to search for, in the air as we fly around, some opening, some clearing, some little bit of a meadow, maybe kind of a brush patch in the timber, where near the tail, preferably downhill from it, so that the fire couldn't have a tree fall down below us and the fire come up from below us. And the spotter will come back after he's discussed that with the pilot, and we'll select that, the spot, and then we'll jump down there near the tail somewhere.
Do you feel the heat of the fire when you're parachuting down?
Sometimes. I know one time I did something spontaneously, and I think if anybody could have seen it from my perspective, they would have judged it to be completely foolish, if not outright crazy. I was coming in on a landing at a certain angle, looking at a sort of a rocky slope on a steep ridge, and I was going to shoot high. The way the wind was buffeting around, I was going to overshoot the spot and maybe clear the ridge and then drift way on down the other side. And the only thing I could do, I just turned really hard to the right and made an S-turn right out over the forest. And the part that I flew out over, I was probably about 300 feet above it, but there were flame links down in the forest that were completely as tall as the canopy, and the trees were 100 feet tall. And so for just maybe 10 or 15 seconds, I was directly out above a totally involved, completely catastrophic burning forest. And I depended on the drive of that parachute to be able to drive back off of that and get back at a better angle and come in on the jump spot, right? And it worked out just fine.
Is that the closest you've ever come to landing in a fire?
No, I've actually landed in fires, but they've been sort of cool, you know. By the time, every now and then you'll get buffeted over and maybe pushed into an area where it's not really life-threatening, but it's maybe put some burn holes in your canopy, and it's an embarrassment that you landed in the fire and really uncomfortable. But I don't, smoke jumpers have never landed in a fire where they were burned from the jump.
Do you think of fires as being alive?
I noticed that they seem to act like they're alive, and I've heard other jumpers say it's like an animal or a living creature, but I know they're not alive. I know they're mindless. I know they would turn and come after you with no more hesitation, you know, than it takes to burn up a bush. They would burn a whole crew. So they, what fire has is a predictable behavior. You can, and experienced firemen look at a fire, they know immediately what to do because they look at it, they look at the stage of development that it's in, they know what it will probably do next if the wind comes up, if the temperature goes up, or if the smoke breaks through an inversion, or if it burns around in a south hill side, which is warmer and drier. So experienced firemen recognize and are quite familiar with the behavior of fire as it builds from just as big around as a campfire until it builds into a blow-up condition. And so because of that, you can sort of interpret what it's doing, and in most cases you can sort of anticipate what it's doing. But it does have this awesome, powerful allure to it. It's beautiful, and it's one of nature's great wonders at work, and we enjoy being close to something that beautiful and that powerful.
Did you ever have a fire come after you? You know, like the wind shifts its direction in your direction, and suddenly the territory that you were on, which had been safe, is no longer safe.
Yes, I have. That's happened a half dozen times in my 35 years of firefighting. Surprisingly, the last two closest calls I've had have happened in the last 3 years. I had a close call in 1997 where that very thing happened, and the situation deteriorated so rapidly that the crew was right on the verge of collapsing all form of organization, and people were going to run for it on their own, which is sort of a desperate condition to be in, because a quarter of a mile of fire line just stood up and suddenly burned across our line, burned our hose, and cut off our route to our safety zone. And then it happened again just south of Delta last summer, the most radical fire behavior that many of us had ever seen in Alaska. It was a combination of strange two events happened simultaneously. The fire was about 40 acres. It suddenly blew up on the head because it was in that time of the afternoon where the heat was maximized, and it had preheated a lot of fuel, and suddenly it stood up with a big wall of flame about 80 feet tall out on the head, pushed a huge giant smoke column way up into the sky. And then the typical wind pattern there around Delta is that this wind blows north through Isabel Pass every afternoon. And suddenly we had a 30 to 35 mile an hour wind hit the fire. And when that did, it bent the smoke column over. You could see the smoke column laying over, and on both sides there were these weird looking braided columns of smoke kind of looping up the side. And then suddenly that wind pushing against that column spawned two counter-rotating vortexes. And so suddenly we had this terrible roar out inside the fire. We couldn't see it, and we were yelling, "What's that roar? What's that roar?" And we started evacuating back down the line, and the crew on the far side, on the west side, they had to abandon, well, they had to run back up this cat line where this tractor was working, and then they ran into the burn, and the vortex over there actually hit one of the guys and burned him fairly badly. On our side, this terrible roar was in the burn, and you could see this huge cloud of brown and gray ash just swirling out in the middle about 100 feet in diameter. And then you saw this snaky kind of a gray snake going up into the sky, and the roar suddenly increased, and the vortex came out of the black into the green, and then the ash was gone. And it revealed a cylinder about 30 feet in diameter that was kind of pink and orange, and it was a tornado of fire. And we'd seen dust fire devils before, and everybody's seen those in regular fires, and they usually aren't that big. They're smaller. I mean, they can pick up logs that are 10 feet long and a foot in diameter and spin them up into the air and even carry them away, but this thing was something more. I don't know. The velocity at the edge of it had to be in excess of 150 miles an hour.
How did you get out of it?
Well, I got out of it. You know, I was the closest to it when it came out of there. It kept coming closer to me, and the way the rest of us were, the other guys ran for this creek, and I happened to be just the closest, and the darn thing was dancing around like they do those, you know, they kind of weave around one way or another, and it seemed like every direction I went, that was the way it was coming. And when it got within about 30 feet of where I was, then I turned and started to run. I knew I had to run some more, and this thing was throwing sparks out in all parts around the perimeter, and the second those sparks hit, they just became running fire. And so that quickly, I was surrounded in running and fire, and I was looking for a water hole to dive in, and the first one I saw was just a mud hole because it's been really dry last summer. And then I had that terrible moment of recognition that firefighters think about once in a while, where what you're seeing is sort of a nightmare, and it's your worst fear come true. Now you're surrounded by fire, and you think that maybe this is the time. Maybe you've stayed one season too longer, and maybe one fire too longer, and maybe, in fact, your career is going to end by being burned to death. And I remember feeling that terrible recognition. But just like that, and I was running, and then that fire devil thing kind of whipped back away from me and sucked back the other way into the burn again. The main smoke column must have pulled it back. And so then it kind of danced back to the north, and then it just whipped across the ground and just tore right out to the north, just streamed across a road and blew out past our gear and sucked a bunch of the parachutes up into the air. And just like that, 20 acres were on fire. And so like that, then when the thing was gone around me, those little fires kind of just petered out, and I ran over to the road. And we all started high-fiving and jumping around on each other and talking about what we'd just seen. For a moment, the winds were like 50 miles an hour. So that was lucky. You have to say that was luck. You know, I've talked to the young smoke jumpers before, and we've talked about dangerous parts of the job. And I told them, you know, in smoke jumping, there's luck and there's skill. And if I had to choose between either one, I'd take luck every time.
Right. There's only a certain amount that's in your control.
Yeah.
So after narrowly escaping this tornado-like fire, and after high-fiving it with your fellow smoke jumpers once you realized you'd survived, then did you get right back to work?
Well, we went over to our gear pile. It was kind of in a clearing, and we got around there. The fire was going in all directions at that time, and we had heard that Jay had been burned. And so when Jay got there, we were shook up, and we saw how Jay was. So we got a helicopter in there and got Jay out. But once we got Jay out and had a bite to eat, and then the fire boss, the state person that was sort of running that fire, got us on the radio, sent a helicopter in and picked us up. Yeah, and we just backed off to a new place. Some of us went across a creek where there'd been a spot fire across that creek. We worked out that night. But yeah, we fought that fire for the next 3 days, actually, to no avail. We had a half a dozen Cat tractors cut 40 miles of line, and we lost the fire every day.
You lost every day?
Yeah, we worked hard. That Friday was when the incident happened, when people almost got burned, and then we worked Saturday, and we lost the fire after a whole day effort Saturday. It just blew up across our Cat lines. And then we lost it Sunday, and then we lost it Monday. So by Monday, it was 18,000 acres and burned by Pump Station 9 and across the Richardson Highway and was headed toward Fort Greeley.
Did you finally control it?
Yeah, you might say that. One of the things about forest fires, once they get up big and rolling, you know, you got to have Mother Nature's help to control them. If we don't catch them initially and stop them, once they get rolling big, you kind of have to have a change in the weather. And we finally got a change in the weather about a week, and then got crews out and got around it. But we had to have Mother Nature's help at that point.
Well, at the age of 59, you're now the oldest smoke jumper in the 60-year history of smoke jumping. And I'm wondering if being older has changed your attitude about risk and your own mortality?
No, not really. I think as I've gotten older and seen all the different, you know, there's been losses, there's been sacrifices over time, I think it's made even more firm in my mind the notion that a life fully lived is worth dying for. If you want to experience life, if you're prone to experience life in a real intense way on the edge, as some people are, I think part of the bargain is, and this may be a self-serving sort of a rationalization, I don't know, but, you know, we believe sort of in fate. I think people that do risky things sort of do. But the overall benefit of being a smoke jumper and working with such a wonderful group of people and experiencing so many magnificent places in the wilderness and parts of the country and the fabulous characters that you get to meet and be part of, there's a price to pay. And every now and then, you know, we offer somebody up on that sacrificial altar, and it's tragic. But for me, if I live to be 200 years old, I'd jump 150 years. It's been wonderful. It's been empowering. It's transformed me. I've watched it do that to other people. They come into the experience and feeling one way about themselves, and after a few seasons as a jumper, they got a more bounce in their step, and they got a new expanded sense of what they are.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It was great to talk with you.
Murray Taylor's new memoir is called Jumping Fire. This will be his last season as a smoke jumper. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, An Obedient Father. This is Fresh Air.